Welcome to today's Federalist Society virtual event. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, and it is also the 10-year anniversary of Brendan Eich being forced out of the company he'd founded for having made a contribution to the successful Prop 8 campaign on same-sex marriage. I'm Alita Cass, Vice President for Strategic Initiatives at the Federalist Society and Director of the Freedom of Thought Project, an initiative addressing new challenges and questions involving freedoms of thought, conscience, and expression. Today's program connects a few recurring themes for the Freedom of Thought Project. How do people experience coercion? Why do people feel unfree? And how do we resolve competing claims to freedom in a free society? And really, why would we care what happened 10 years ago at Mozilla? It was a private company making a business decision about who should run the organization. Why, even 10 years later, do people remember Mozilla and Brendan Eich? I am delighted to have Todd Zwicky and Inez Stepman with us to discuss what happened, why we care, and what it means to live in a free society. Professor Todd Zwicky is the George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at Scalia Law School and former executive director of the George Mason Law and Economics Center. Inez is senior policy analyst at the Independent Women's Forum, host of the High Noon with Inez Stepman podcast, which hosts conversations with heterodox thinkers on important cultural and political subjects. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of our experts on today's program. We encourage audience members to submit questions for our panelists through the Q&A feature at the bottom of their screen. Thank you so much for joining us today. Inez, the floor is yours.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for hosting this conversation and for reminding us all with the topic of what actually occurred 10 years ago. It really got me thinking what I thought then, how I saw the political landscape, how I thought about freedom of speech then versus now, how I thought about what's necessary for a free society then versus now. I think if it's hard to deny that it was really a watershed moment and unfortunately a harbinger for things to come for the next 10 years. But the first thing, Professor Zwicky, I want to ask you is, for those who don't remember it or perhaps are too young to remember this incident, what happened with Brendan Eich at Mozilla? What events transpired that then became sort of something that sounds very familiar to us 10 years later?
Thanks, Inez, and thanks, Alita, for marking this this dubious anniversary of 10 years, because 10 years ago, sort of the Earth shifted on its axis. I think we saw a dramatic change in the world, in both with what happened with Brendan Eich, and in many ways, it really was the big old canary in the coal mine that gave us an auger of where everything was going. Brendan Eich, as you said, was basically the founder of Mozilla that created the Netscape browser that was very popular. I used to use it back in the day. He was sort of it's an unusual corporate structure at Mozilla. I don't think we need to go into it. But he helped create, he was Mozilla's chief architect, AOL bot Netscape. Eventually they created the Mozilla Foundation, kind of restarted. And he was the chief technical officer. And continued developing the Netscape browser. Finally, in 2014, as sort of the guy who knew the most about the company, he was named the CEO of the Mozilla Corporation. And immediately, March 24th, 2014, and immediately the world freaked out. It turned out, as Alita said at the outside, Eich had donated a whopping $1,000 to the in 2008, several years before, to California's Proposition 8, which had called for which defined marriage as traditional marriage, one man and one woman, and not as same-sex marriage. He then also supported, as a political candidate, Tom McClintock, who had run for office and was a supporter of Proposition 8. It's kind of unclear what happened after that, but it led to certain members of Mozilla's board resigning. And what really happened that was significant is that employees freaked out. And out in California, employees freak out, but this was a freak out basically by the idea that by donating to what, as Alita said, a majority of Californians agreed with, which was defining marriage at the time as one man and one woman, he caused, upset all the LGBT community at Mozilla. They said it was intolerable. They could not work for this person who had donated money to Proposition 8. And activist employees and others ramped up the pressure for him to resign. 2 days later, Ike expressed sorrow and for causing pain and promised he would work with LGBT communities and allies at Mozilla. That still wasn't enough. And finally, on April 3rd, Ike stepped down, basically under all this pressure. And what's significant, I think, most about this was the outside activism that forced people to put pressure on Mozilla, but also the employees, the rank and file employees of Mozilla, who believed that they had the right to determine who the CEO would be and the criteria under which they should be expected to work for the company. And at the time, it didn't create a lot of attention, I think. But for whatever reason, I noticed it at the time, and I said, this is a significant change in history. There's a lot going on here that needed to be taken account of. And as you and Alita suggested, this has to some extent become mainstream since then and become more and more common. This was kind of a prototype for sort of corporate wokeism and activism and employee sort of activism in the time since.
Yeah, before I get into some of the broader social questions and then perhaps even some of the legal questions around this, I want to share a bit about how I saw this incident. I grew up in Silicon Valley, and I remember the Prop 8 battles. I remember these tactics being used in 2008, starting to crop up specifically around this battle. There was a small chain in San Diego called Golden Spoon. Same kind of story. The CEO donated privately, I think it was something even more absurd, like $200, right, to the Prop 8 campaign. There was a boycott of that ice cream chain, right? And in that case, I think they just suffered, the business as a whole took the hit because it was, and maybe we can get into this, it was like a single proprietor who had a small chain. It wasn't like a publicly traded company. But there were sort of these rumblings. And I remember having these discussions at the time because, I mean, obviously I didn't like some of these tactics, but I had a much more libertarian response. Like, you can't force people to work with or associate with people with whom they find, you know, their views, they find those views abhorrent. They don't, you know, we have a right to fire, you know, Mozilla has a right to fire its CEO. And my dad and my parents came from a communist country, I should say. And my dad had a very different reaction to this and immediately sort of picked it out as something that's incompatible with the continuation of a free society. And that even though on paper, this wasn't this is not a First Amendment violation, it's not a free speech violation, he sort of recognized it immediately as something that would chill speech to the extent that it would be extremely difficult to operate sort of a free speech, democratic, small d democratic society. And so he saw it immediately as sort of a red beacon of tyranny of a certain type coming over the horizon. I thought that was interesting, like, given his background and mine, growing up in America, that I sort of immediately put this in the framework of, well, everybody has the right to do this. And now I definitely, you know, I guess as you get older, you see more and more of these incidents where you say my parents were right. But it's clear that this kind of framework for what we now call cancellation has incredibly impacted our ability to speak freely, to the extent that 65 up to 70% of Americans in surveys say that they self-censor. So given all of that background, I mean, how did you think about this? You say you picked it out. There were a couple people, I want to just give credit. There were a couple people when I was going back and reading about this, I didn't remember it being a big thing, but Dennis Prager, the talk show host, you know, he hosted a whole show on this saying if, you know, if there's no boycott response from the right and from religious people on this, that we are going to lose the ability to sort of freely discuss things. Robbie P. George wrote an article in First Things about this. So some people, and apparently you did, recognize this early as what it was. But how did you think about the problem in terms of putting it into buckets that we now think about, right? First Amendment buckets, free speech, freedom of association, public accommodations, employment law. Like how did you recognize this as something new? And how did you attempt or start to put it into the sort of structure of rights that we take for granted or did take for granted in America?
Right. And obviously, understand and was and am sympathetic to the libertarian view, right? In the sense of sort of this isn't government coercion, right? It's private activity. But two things sort of were in the background here that I thought very much, thinking very much like your parents, which is that there are habits of a free society that go beyond sort of what is legal or what is illegal, right? And it was already pretty clear to me at that point that one of the habits of a free society that's necessary is toleration. And already by 2014, you're slipping from this line from tolerating, everybody should be expected to tolerate things that that they don't approve of, to the idea that you must affirmatively approve of things, right? You had an affirmative obligation to endorse certain good principles and that sort of thing. And the left at that point was already starting to use these boycott type activities, as far as I call Rush Limbaugh boycott, you know, boycotting advertisers, all this sort of stuff. So we saw this going on. But one of the other things about the free society is that most of the free society needs to not be political. When you show up at work, you should be allowed to do your job without being political. A lot of nonprofit, you know, the things you do in your free time and that sort of thing. And I kind of had this in the back of my head was, you know, we live in their system of democratic capitalism. And what that means is that you need to be able to participate in the democratic process without losing your job. And you need to be able to go and do your job without being forced to endorse particular political systems. And it requires a facility to distinguish what is an appropriate role for democracy and politics and what is an appropriate role for people to be able to earn a living. And I believe it was Milton Friedman way back in Capitalism and Freedom who said one of the glorious things about capitalism, one of the glorious things about the free society is you don't care whether the person who grows your grain is a Muslim, a Jew, or a Protestant, right? What you want is to engage with somebody on the terms that they're offering of high quality products at a low price in a competitive competitive market. And I immediately saw that this was a merging of these things, right? That to say you've got to take certain woke positions on political issues fundamentally is no different from saying, you can't be a Jew and open your business here, or you must endorse Christian values in order to be somebody that I will work for and that sort of thing. And, you know, against the backdrop of the 20th century, it was pretty clear. I mean, kind of the alarm bells went off immediately in my head, much like your parents, which is this merging of politics with the private sphere of, you know, sort of voluntary organizations, civil society organizations in the market was a very alarming sort of thing. And this was a big ramping up of that question. The other thing that struck me very much at the time is it said in the promo, this is not a stable equilibrium, right? There's the problem with a lot of these things is there's no logical stopping point. Which is you could say, the problem was he donated to the anti-same-sex marriage initiative, right? But why is that going to, why couldn't you say, well, he voted for it? We're allowed to ask, how did you vote on Proposition 8? when you're appointing somebody, right? If they voted against it, is that enough? Are you allowed to say, well, you needed to vote for it? Well, you have enough resources. Why didn't you donate to Proposition 8 as a criteria for running this company, right? And so once you move away from toleration, and once you move away from disconnecting those things, there's no logical stopping point between saying you can't donate to Proposition 8 versus you must vote for and publicly endorse this position, even if you don't agree with it, as a criteria for doing your job, right? And that's very much where we have ended up now. That's very much where we've ended up, where people must affirmatively endorse positions and they demand that their corporations endorse particular political positions. And so it was obvious to me from the beginning that there was no logical stopping point between those polars, opposites.
Yeah, let's talk about stopping points, because even in a very free society like the United States, let's say in 1980, there have always been views that have been considered beyond the pale. The most obvious example I always use is having a swastika tattooed on your forehead has never been good for your employment prospects in the United States, right? That being said, there seems like there are two questions on the stopping point, right? Or two dimensions of it. One is, who decides what things are so fringe and offensive that it, you know, like it doesn't fall in that apolitical zone that you were talking about? And the second point is, you know, whether you're using your job to further that view, right? So like here, I'll give the second, the one example on the one hand was the guy with the swastika tattoo on his forehead, you know, perhaps a coffee shop doesn't want to hire him because so many of their customers find that offensive that they actually find they lose business. On the other hand, there's Colin Kaepernick, right, who used time on the field as an athlete to protest in a way that a lot of people and customers found offensive, right? And the NFL put a stop to that. And so I guess I want to ask you about those two questions, because there have always been limits, even in a society that we have, you know, protections, legal protections under the First Amendment for example, you know, Nazi speech. But here we have this instance, and I think it is both qualitatively and quantitatively different, of somebody who's, first of all, not using his views in the office, right? Yes. They actually had to leak this. Yes. This was not somebody who was going into the office and talking about his political views,
right,
and therefore the employees were made uncomfortable. That's one line that was crossed here. And the second one is Proposition 8 passed in California, right? So 52% of the state voted in favor of retaining the definition of marriage as one man and one woman. At the time, this was not at all a fringe belief. In fact, it was a majoritarian belief just a few years before this happened. And so there's a question of who decides where that line is. And there's a bit of a like sort of a class question. And by that, I don't even mean, you know, the rich versus the poor, but there is sort of this influential academic professional class that is pulling away from the rest of the country in terms of its beliefs at this time in 2014. And in a really, in the first real way, flexes that muscle, that both financial muscle and cultural muscle, and says, okay, we are declaring this belief, despite it being incredibly common and perhaps majority belief in the country, we are declaring this belief beyond the pale. This is like being a Nazi, and right, we're going to exclude these people from employment and public life.
And that class is basically taken upon themselves to determine what is the reasonable bounds of acceptable opinion. And as we all know, that was the position of Barack Obama at that time, right? Until all of a sudden became politically convenient to switch or announce what his actual position was. And I think that you're pressing on exactly the right lines, Inez. And traditionally, what we've done is sort of been able to count on people to use sort of common sense and good judgment to draw these lines. I think the private time versus on the job time is incredibly important. And that's gotten mushed together over time, which is that People should be allowed to participate in the democratic process on their own time, on their own social media accounts, without that being part of whether or not they're allowed to make a living or not. You can't have a democratic society unless people feel like they can express their views without worrying about getting fired, getting their bank accounts canceled like people do now, and the like. It's just not, you just can't have a free society if you can't participate as a full democratic citizen on your private time and not bring that into work. But what we've done now is we punish people for what they do in their private activity. And more people demand that they should be allowed to express their political views at work, like Colin Kaepernick, or this recent case of the person who wanted to wear a BLM badge, I think, on their Home Depot apron, right? All these sorts of things, which I think it's reasonable to say, no, that's something you should do in your private time. And so I think that lack of nuance is kind of disappeared. That line drawing, that pragmatic sort of sense of self-restraint and respect and toleration for other people's views has been eroded. And it's become more and more subjective as well. I recall when a bunch of the bank CEOs testified before Congress, I believe with Senator Toomey, said to them, they had all taken a statement against the Georgia voting law. They had condemned it. And he said, can you name one provision in the law that that you object to? And of course, none of them could. They kind of looked at each other like idiots and said, well, none of us have read the law. And finally, one of them fessed up and said, well, some of our employees felt disenfranchised by that law. Didn't say they were even living in Georgia, right? These are employees at these multinational banks who, quote, felt disenfranchised, even though they couldn't say that they were disenfranchised. They had a feeling, and that was enough that the banks felt like they should be required, permitted, extolled to take a position on it, on this purely subjective sort of notion that people dreamed up in order to make this an issue. And so, you know, the final thing I'll say about that is people can always come up with the extreme examples, and we always understand that, right? But here's the bottom line is, when you look at sort of how the left has weaponized these this cancel culture stuff in recent years, I would say it begins with the Nazis, but it never ends with the Nazis. Right? They say, well, surely you can't have the person wearing the Nazi swastika on their forehead or whatever, right? But then if you look at universities, for example, it starts off with the Nazis, then it becomes Miley Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter, and pretty soon you've got George Will being canceled, right? They're constantly sort of pushing the boundaries in order to more and more draw in the fences as to what they see as a permissible range of expressed opinion. And so to some extent, I think if people can't be relied on to have nuance, to have judgment, to think about where a reasonable line is to allow people to participate as democratic citizens, but then at the same time restrain them from acting out at work. Unfortunately, then you start looking at prohibitions, all or nothing rules, all these sorts of restraints, which makes us, I think, all less free, but it results from a lack of character and judgment and prudence on how we act towards each other on a voluntary basis.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those blunt instruments that, at least I know for my own behalf, like I have had to reconsider, right? The necessity, for example, and one very dense, you know, part of the U.S. code is all kinds of employment protections, and yeah. In particular, all kinds right. of anti-discrimination employment protections. You cannot be fired for any number of reasons in America, right? There's a long list of protected characteristics. One of those characteristics is not, at least on the federal level, you know, political orientation or belief. Is this something that, I mean, we should be considering. Obviously, as you said, it does in some sense make us less free in the same way that public accommodations in the Civil Rights Act restricts freedom of association. It restricts businesses from choosing who they do and do not want to work with and hire and serve as customers on certain bases. Should we be considering, do we want to live in a world where we have employment protections for all characteristics except diversity of thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do need to be having those discussions. If employer, one of the big problems here, Inez, was when Mozilla did this, a lot of what was going on at the time was it was just a free pass. You know, there was a decade for which woke corporate activity was essentially a free pass for the corporations. And you mentioned Dennis Prager, other mentions at the time that maybe we should like boycott these people. Maybe we need to strike back. And for a variety of reasons, conservatives didn't respond to that and that sort of thing. And so all that did was embolden them, right? It emboldened the activists, it emboldened the employees, and emboldened the corporations. And so they just thought this was an easy PR victory, essentially, right? That they were getting it from one side. Universities have gone through the same thing, right? Where they've gotten activists for decades from one side, and they apply blatantly clear double standards, which have become, quite clear over the past several months. Because when they get pressure from one side and not the other side, then especially if they're sympathetic to that side, then they just cave to that, right? And now they're starting to get it from both sides. They're starting to get it in a tit for tat sort of way from conservative activists. Ask Bud Light whether they think this is still a free pass, or Target, whether they think this is still a free pass, because now what you're doing is starting to see more activity. And so, where we're at now is this tit for tat world, where it seems like the only way to get these corporations to stop this is boycott after boycott, reciprocal boycotts, right? Which I don't think that's a very nice way of doing this. I don't think that's very compatible with a free society and that sort of thing. And so, to some extent, I think starting to think about things like tying their own hands, like saying, we're not going to fire people based on their political beliefs, so we're not going to take away people's bank accounts based on their political beliefs. I think the corporations should want that at this point, because they're kind of in a no-win situation. But even if they don't want it, I think it's time to start thinking about whether that needs to be required of them, when it is very clear that they're not interested in applying these standards in a uniform or even-handed way based on different political beliefs and the like.
Well, if we're going to sort of wade into those waters, we're going to have to consider who has First Amendment rights, right? Who has the ability to speak, and what entities have the ability to speak? Because here there's another spectrum that I'd like to introduce to you. It is something that I think we're going to have to both in, I expect that the Supreme Court will have to wade through this in the next 5 to 10 years. But then us as a society also going to have to wade through this, because we're not just now talking about employment. A lot of the examples you're giving are actually from the customer side, right? Discrimination against an entire class of customers. And often that's because of a type of market power, right? If we think about the small case, if we think about, for example, the Christian baker who doesn't want to bake a cake for a gay wedding, obviously that's not against the customer, it's against a particular expression, refusing to do a particular expression, but leave that distinction aside for a moment. In that case, there are, probably on the same block, there's another baker who is willing to perform that service for the customer for the right price, right? So that's an individual proprietor. When you start to talk about, for example, Amazon web hosting services, they have such a large market share, or at minimum, the other companies that hold substantial market share in whatever, banks are a good example of this, right? We have had examples of debanking. The NRA has difficulty placing their money because a lot of banks don't want to hold their bank account, which has millions of dollars, and you would think banks would like to hold. There are other examples of that. even if there are many actors in a market and we don't think of it as traditional, you know, antitrust problem or monopoly problem, if everybody agrees on those same boundaries that we were talking about earlier, right? If everybody agrees that Brandon Eich is beyond the pale, even though he's smack in the middle of the American political spectrum on this particular issue, then you have a situation in which the customer or the employee who's fired has very little recourse to the quote unquote free market, right? He can't go, it's not just Mozilla today that is unwilling to hire someone like Brandon Eich. It's virtually all of the tech world. So if you have particular skills, right? So there's this sort of collective market problem that isn't being solved by, say, what Milton Friedman in the book you cited hope, right, would solve it. The natural self-interest of one company to want to serve the customer that's being booted from the other one. If we are going to go down this road, you know, how do we deal with who has these First Amendment or these freedom of speech rights? Because we have large corporations who are saying, well, it's our expression that we don't want to work with anybody. That's saying something about us that we don't want to say. And we as a unit, as a publicly traded corporation, we have First Amendment rights not to interact with this class of customer or not to hire this class of employee. So, you know, who has these rights? And how do we balance those kinds of things in the public square? The rights, quote unquote, of the corporation to say what it wants to say, but be a business, and the right of the individual that's necessary in democracy to be able to participate, as you say, in a political system that requires people, at least when they're not on the clock, right, to be able to express their opinions freely.
Yeah, there's a lot there, and I think you're hitting on the really salient issues. And another way of reframing it, right, is think about the Civil Rights Act, and you know, a lot of libertarians over time have said, well, they opposed the Civil Rights Act because it required businesses to deal with people who they didn't want to deal with, right? It's the same thing as, you know, people who are making the argument today. And I think a pretty reasonable argument could be made that whatever freedom means, in some net sense, that expands the Civil Rights Act expanded freedom, right? To allow Blacks to be able to travel and be able to get hotel rooms and that sort of thing. Yeah, that was a restriction on the freedom of racist hoteliers, right? Often backed by strong community sanctions, even if not the government, right? It's not like they were going to offer hotel rooms, you know, when the Klan would then come and burn crosses on their front yard or boycott their businesses and that sort of thing. So to say you have to accept Black customers, I think a pretty strong case could be made to say that on net, that expanded freedom, however that term is defined in United States society. And so I think we're pressing on a lot of the same issues here. If you feel like you cannot participate fully as a citizen in the democratic process because it is going to mean you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your bank account, all these sorts of things, then you are not free. And as you said, you mentioned Silicon Valley. If you want to be in Silicon Valley, basically, these are the positions you have to hold, right? I'm an academic, so I really understand the way in which there are clear political litmus tests. And I don't think anybody can seriously doubt it at this point, that there are clear political litmus tests on people's ability to get hired, promoted, succeed in higher education. And I felt this, you know, up close and personal during COVID. I had COVID. I taught in person because I had COVID and I was told that I was safe. Came around the vaccines. My university imposed a vaccine mandate and they did not respect until I sued them. Natural immunity is an exemption to the COVID vaccine mandate. And I'll tell you, I woke up every day thinking that my career as an academic might be over. Not just my career teaching at George Mason, my career as an academic, because there's a limited number of jobs. variety of demographic and other reasons why I would not be at the top of that list. And so to say you can just go get another job, like a lot of libertarians say, it's just not a serious, it's not a grown-up serious reality about what the world is like. You can create these little fictional models of the first best world where this is the case, but it's not the case. When you invest your entire life in a particular company, that makes a difference, right? If I've talked to people who were members of the military who were 6 months away from their pension vesting, and they were basically going to have to decide were they going to get vaccinated or not, right? And some said yes, and some said no, because the financial penalty of losing their pension would just be too huge, right? And so clearly there is a power relationship there. It's not equal in every situation, but clearly to say that there's just these frictionless employment markets are just, it's just silly. It's a childish approach to how the world actually operates. And I think in terms of thinking about what the threats are to freedom and how we protect freedom, we need to take the world as it is. We're not in the world of the first best of magic markets, but we're in the world of the second best, where there are power asymmetries, where there are limits on your ability to move and get another job, or huge financial penalties such as losing your pension if you leave early from a job for something that has nothing to do with your ability to actually do the job.
Yeah, and the sort of build it yourself answer, right, which is the second half of the go find another job equation. You know, sometimes it is possible, although some of these structures that we've been talking about, like Amazon Web Hosting Services or others, I mean, we saw what happened to Parler. There were two basically market gatekeepers for apps to the market, and both of them decided for similar political reasons to basically kill Parler, and they succeeded in doing so, more or less. I mean, Parler still exists, but it's nowhere near. I mean, it was a company that had huge growth potential and was gaining, you know, tons of users every day because it wanted to introduce this free speech model. And it was effectively killed by that. But I guess at some point, the larger worry is not only is this extreme much more difficult than it is in the frictionless model that you're talking about, but also that the danger is that we lose that space you were talking about when we initially started talking or this conversation, right? Because we lose that apolitical space for tolerance that makes us the largest, if you want to talk about these in libertarian terms, the largest free trade zone in the in the world is the United States, where there have always been vast disagreements about important things, religion, right? You know, very deeply held moral beliefs, but we have this culture, this mercantile culture of separating a little bit between business and private belief. And that, I mean, the description of what you're talking about, everybody change jobs, build it yourself, right? That starts to look a lot like two different societies.
Yeah, and a pulling apart. And so people say, well, we can just have a red economy and a blue economy. It's right. That's not the world. That's not the ideal world to me, right? The beauty of the United States is this ability for everybody to become Americans and everybody to be free and to respect each other and to govern ourselves and that sort of thing. And so I'm very troubled by that whole scenario, right? And a better scenario would be one, I think, that does have people develop the habits, the character of being a free person, allowing people to disagree with them, vote differently and that sort of thing. Gave the example earlier of the baker, right? Who doesn't want to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. And there's 20 other bakeries around, right? First, that person has no power. Second, the question you have to ask yourself is, you know, in the past, what is the obsession with forcing that baker to relent, right? What, why is it so important that you must put your, you know, sort of put your boot on the neck of that baker and make them cry uncle, right? And so that's not a very, that, I mean, that attitude that we must force people to, even if, you know, just purely for symbolic reasons, it's not like there were no other cake bakers in the town, that they could go somewhere else where they could find somebody who would gladly, enthusiastically do it, right? This idea that you must force people to choose. And it's this idea of, you know, silence is violence is the idea on the left. And, you know, when I don't understand why conservatives or libertarians or whatever pretend like the left doesn't say the things they don't say. When they say silence is violence, they mean it, which is you're not, you must choose a side. That's their view, right? That was what I understood with Brendan Eich, which is it's not enough to just vote for or against Proposition 8. You must be positively and, you know, publicly in favor of what we expect you to do, because if you're not, then you're against us. If you're not for us, you're against us. And that attitude is the exact antithesis of what you were saying in terms of a lack of tolerance, a lack of allowing people to have different opinions, which is the underlying, you know, nature, the essential essence of a democratic system, and the essential logic, as you said, of the First Amendment, of toleration of different religions, toleration of different speech. And we all know the kind of friction that you can get in when people fight over religion. And nowadays, you know, the way people use speech, especially on the left, it's basically a form of religious zealotry that I don't think is that much different from what we've seen in the past, and not that much different in terms of the implications for societal divisiveness and the like.
Yeah, given the choice between, you know, the state taking a more active role and essentially forcing us to do business together, whether that looks like anti-discrimination law, whether that looks like, you know, starting to look at who exactly has what entities actually should or can exercise free speech or expressive rights. Those both seem to me to be a preferable solution than developing totally separate societies. But at this point, I'd like to remind everybody listening, if you have questions, I am keeping track of the Q&A tab. I'll get to that real soon at the end of the discussion. Try to ask your questions of the professor. So please do put questions in that Q&A tab if you have them. And to wrap it up from my questions, I wanted to ask you whether you think the greatest threat to freedom in the landscape that we live in today, given all that we've discussed, and we live in a post-Brandon Eich world, the greatest threat to freedom as we understand it, not narrowly tailored in the courtroom, but as we have understood it as people, as Americans, is most under threat from the government, from the private sector, or from some combination, as we've seen, you know, the sort of unholy alliance we've seen in the COVID case that you're bringing up, the vaccine mandates, but also in some of these NCLA cases, we've seen emails going back and forth that in a lot of times functionally, these are the same people going in and out with the same views, rotating in and out of government agencies and top corporations. So where do you see the threat most coming for traditional American freedoms? Well, like, where do you see that being most dangerous today?
It reminds me, you talked about your parents, and I had a friend who passed away a couple of years ago, who a great professor, Steve Pavich, who grew up in Yugoslavia and managed to live under both the Nazis and the communists. And he once observed the difference between the Nazis and the communists was that the Nazis wanted your obedience and the communists wanted your heart and mind, which is the communists wanted you to obey, not because you felt forced to obey, but because you wanted to merge yourself into the mass, right? And so that was, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, we saw the kind of way in which communism, you know, infected every aspect of society, from your workplace to the young pioneers sort of corrupting the civil society institutions, to the family, sort of everything being politicized in a way of sort of shaping people's character. And so that's, I mean, this merging of government power with private power, the social milieu, in the like, I think is part of that. I think the other thing that I observe now is that there is this sense in which it just wears people down. That the relentlessness of the political sort of pushing, right? The constantly in your face sort of thing about it, in terms of every consumption decision, every in the workplace, you know, all this sort of stuff. I think a lot of people just essentially just say enough, right? And there are people who will keep fighting back, and sometimes they end up getting canceled, right? But a lot of people, I think, just basically feel worn out by it. And so they just relent, they just keep their mouth shut. And I think that's a very dangerous, dangerous situation, that at least at this point, they're kind of conforming externally, even if they're kind of keeping their views to themselves and just kind of trying to get through to the end of time until they retire. But we see this, I think, sort of slowly but surely eroding the underlying fabric of a free society in the notions of tolerance that we were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people think about censorship in the Soviet Union, which we all recognize as a tyrannical society, as Stalinism, right? Sort of high Stalinism, people going to the gulag for minor deviations from the party line. The reality of most of the Soviet Union wasn't that. I mean, it was more like something that is recognizable to us today, which is you couldn't get the association card to practice your profession because the party wouldn't recommend you for it, because right. It was rumored that you held certain, you know, anti-socialist beliefs. And to your point, if you construct a society on the basis that everybody is a Solzhenitsyn, you're not going to get very far with a free society. But perhaps we are both too dour about this. So I think this is a former classmate of mine from law school. Jack asks, how much of the left's success in the cancellation market is cowardice on the part of elites, quote, on our side, who, desperate for the approval of their counterparts on the left, kowtow to every woke demand? If that's part of the problem, shouldn't part of the solution be for ordinary people to exert their market power to demand better? Better elites who will stand up for them, and not just somewhat more protective laws. Are we giving short shrift to the power of essentially, you know, should we expect maybe not people to be Solzhenitsyn and lose their jobs, but should we expect people to be willing to stand up to the opprobrium of the New York Times crowd and be excluded from cocktail parties? That doesn't seem like too high an enormous bar to ask from people for the maintenance of a free society.
Yeah, and I'll just say, I mean, it was no fun suing my employer over the COVID vaccine, and I did not have a until Glenn Young, the day Glenn Youngkin was inaugurated and banned vaccine mandates in Virginia. I did not have a good I did not have a good night's sleep for a very long time up until till the people of Virginia elected Glenn Youngkin and he banned vaccine mandates for state employees. So, you know, and I could have maybe just quietly gotten a exemption or something rather than suing. So why did I do it? Now, I'll just confess, I felt like I had to. And one of the things I learned from that experience is, why did I have to? Because there is a sense in which we kind of mock the left's, you know, idea of privilege. But I do feel like I'm somebody who's in a privileged position in some sense. I'm an academic. I have tenure. I have the ability to synthesize information and make arguments and that sort of thing. And I, in many ways, did feel like I had to step up because of the role I had and give voice to all the people who I couldn't give voice to stand against the wind, right? And luckily, I teach at Scalia Law School, which is a very unique law school. I treasure my colleagues and their courage and their independence. And, you know, they respected what I was doing, even if they didn't agree with me. They understood that I had good reasons for I was doing it, you know, and that's the reason I teach there rather than other law schools is because I value the environment that we have at that law school. So I think to Jack's point, I think it is incumbent on elites to conservative elites to do more that if we have power, if we have some degree of privilege, I think we owe it, if we believe in the free society, to do something about it. And I think, you know, one of the, and I didn't do it for this reason, but I was unbelievably gratified and touched by the hundreds of emails I got from people, you know, from a cook in New York City who was he thought he was going to lose his job over New York City's vaccine mandate, to nurses who, you know, served on the front lines of COVID, to teachers who wanted to be in their school teaching in person, all these sorts of things. But all the people who expressed that to me, because they just didn't have the kind of power that I have. And so I think there is a need for those who can have courage to have courage and not just get along to go along.
Yeah. And especially, I think we need to be smarter about it in terms of elite exercising that kind of elite power. I mean, I think associations in the academic world, sort of NATO Article 5 type associations, I think Professor George is the one who came up with that kind of idea, but basically to connect heterodox academics so that, you know, you have a kind of collective power. That's one idea. I really like Judge Ho's exhortations to the federal judiciary. And this is something where we have obviously exercised political power. By we, I mean, moderate and right. We have plenty of appointees in the judicial system. If they were to refuse to hire clerks from Yale Law School because of that school's attitude towards freedom of speech, right? That would have a substantial effect, I think.
And so it has. I mean, it's like, does anybody think that Stanford Law School would have come out in support of free speech, but for the fact after the Kyle Duncan incident, but for the fact that they got added to the list? Of course not, right? And same with Yale, right? Now, all of a sudden, they're making noises about being in favor of free speech and the like. And so I think that's an excellent example, Inez, of situations in which using your power matters. And to some extent, you know, when I heard what Judge Ho was doing, it's like people say, well, this isn't right. You shouldn't punish these innocent people for this. And it's like, my response is, either you believe in free speech or you don't. And either you believe that this is good or bad for the country, what these universities are doing. And if this isn't your solution, what is your solution? Because if conservatives have a strategy for dealing with cancel culture, I'm not aware of it. If there is a strategy, it's a pretty bad one, because it doesn't seem to have been working very well for the past decade. So in some sense, like you're saying, let's actually, if it's a problem, let's try to do something about it. And yes, there will be unintended consequences. Yes, we need to be careful about how we do it. But what we've been doing since, you know, for the past 10 years didn't work. And the only thing that seems to have worked is, like you're saying with Judge Ho and Judge Branch, the Bud Light boycott, right? There are certain things where kind of using the power that conservatives have, and I don't want to get into a tit for tat game, right? That's not my ideal situation here, but tit for tat in a game theory logic, and I'm an economist, is to bring us back to a cooperative equilibrium. That's where I would like to be. I would like to be in a world in which everything isn't politicized all the time, where most of our lives are apolitical, and we can just have our friends, and we can go to our PTA meetings, and we can go to work, and, you know, not have to worry about politics being in our face all the time.
Yeah, maybe we're relying on the wrong Cold War comparisons. We should be looking to mutually assured destruction. I want to combine two anonymous questions about employment non-discrimination law, which we discussed as a possible solution for some of this. And one person points out, in California, there is protection for adverse employment action due to the employee's political beliefs or activities. Why, and I don't know the answer to this question, why wasn't that effective for Brandon Eich? I don't know if, and then two, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's been effective overall in California. So perhaps that's something we should consider if we are going to think about expanding anti-discrimination provisions to belief, you know, has this worked?
That's a great question. And I've not dug into the details of how this actually plays out, but I do want to say two things, right? Which is, first is, any time you do trigger government activity or new regulation or new laws, you're going to have both intended and unintended consequences. And so we need to be aware of that, right? There's going to be both. I think one argument that is often overstated is, well, if we give this power to conservatives, won't the left be able to use that power themselves? I think that's just not a very, in my view, a weighty argument. And the reason is, it's not like leftist politicians or activists or companies are just sitting around waiting for authority to be able to do the things that they're doing. They're just doing it, right? They're not asking for permission. They're just doing it. And you mentioned the Net Choice, the Murthy case and the censorship of social media, right? Which is, they were just doing it. They were going right up the line, maybe over the line. They knew where the line was. The government can't do this. So we're going to do this, 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 and this to get to what we want to do. Doing the same thing with banking. We're going to do this, 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 and this, right? We're not going to, you know, use as much power as we can, see if we can get away with it, right? So it's not like, I think, that the unintended consequence of, oh, the left will be able to use this, is that much of a difference, because they might be able to do a little bit more than they're doing now, but they're doing it all already. And so I think that's an important point in terms of intended and unintended consequences. But you do have the issue with employment law and the like, which is that if you do bring a suit, if you do bring an action, right, then you do have this problem of it's kind of on your record, right, that you're kind of person who sues over a lot of this. And you know, if you're a conservative in Silicon Valley or that sort of thing, and you still want to be able to get a job in tech, are you really going to, is the path of least resistance to try to sue and try to prove one of these cases, or to just try to scramble and find something else or something like that? And so, you know, again, as you're saying, it's not all about the legal remedies, right? There is this social structure behind it that people still have to overcome in order to be able to operationalize and use these legal rights that they have.
So what about corporate structure? So we have a question about shareholder power. Do shareholders have some kind of remedy against the hijacking of a company by activist management? You can ask the reverse question, what remedies does a company have against activist shareholders, right? Because I've seen politics being introduced by both sides of that equation. And then there's a question from a bit ago as well about who First Amendment's touching on some of the questions that we did discuss, like who should have First Amendment rights? What organizations and structures, corporate structures, should we attach First Amendment rights to? Should we be considering Mitt Romney's dictum that corporations are people, right? So kind of what do you see within the actual structure of corporations that is either making this problem worse or potentially might provide a remedy for it?
Yeah, and obviously you could bring shareholder actions, that sort of thing. One of the things that's tricky with that is it's really hard to draw a direct line between sort of, you know, everybody says go woke, go broke, but it's really hard to draw that line for a variety of reasons. There's a lot of things that affect corporate profitability, and shareholders trying to do that is tricky. And if you look at the empirical evidence on ESG, for example, there's very little evidence that sort of ESG systematically reduces shareholder returns or anything like that, or the evidence is at least very mixed on that. But here's how I've come to think of it, Inez, is, and libertarians are very guilty of this. Libertarians think of this as sort of all through the lens of economics, right? But they'll say, like, you know, the Twitter thing, that sort of thing is, oh, well, you know, eventually there'll be market entry in 5 or 10 years, and, you know, maybe these monopolies eventually break down. And I'm perfectly willing to say that. That seems like pretty sound economics, but that's not what the harm is, right? To focus on, you know, it's kind of like one of these things of the hammer and the nail, right? When it's if it's a corporation, everybody thinks that like shareholder rights are the right way to confront these issues. And that's not obviously correct to me. I think it could be part of it. The problem here, I think, is not a problem of corporate governance and shareholders. It's a problem of democracy. It's a problem of corporations acting in a democratic way. And so the way I think about it is that there are these spillover effects on society and on freedom and on the democratic world that are not just economics. If you can't participate as a citizen in the democratic process in a full way because you are afraid of economic warfare against you, then that's not just an economic question. And that's the point I think people need to think about, right? Yeah, maybe in 10 years, you know, as you said, build your own Twitter. They built their own Twitter that was called Parler, right? So now you've got to build your own internet, essentially, just so you can build your own Twitter. And maybe that can be done someday, but it's going to take a long time. In the meantime, what is going to be the impact on the democratic process? What is going to be the impact on people's ability to speak and hear opinions in the world? All those sorts of things are not economic questions. And I think the questions we have here about employment are not economic questions. They're questions of democracy. They're questions of freedom and the like. And I think sort of, yes, you can use shareholder governance to the extent you can. But that I think is a very indirect and not obviously effectual way of getting what we're really concerned about, which is people being able to speak their minds as democratic citizens without risking their livelihoods.
Yeah, that's about does it for us. I'm sorry for the questions that I couldn't answer, bring up. There were so many great questions. One person brought up 42 USC 1985 case based on pressure on a bank. I don't even know what that's about. I'd be really interested to learn more questions about what's happening across the pond with regard to free speech and gender ideology. Lots of great questions. So sorry I couldn't get to everybody's questions, but just to sort of put a pin on this discussion, and I think Professor Zubecki has done an incredible job in that last several paragraphs of saying that there is this fundamental problem here that economics doesn't really address, and that a libertarian framework doesn't really address and doesn't recognize sort of as the world around us. And I want to briefly read something from Irving Kristol, the senior, a fantastic speech he gave in 1972 to Milton Friedman's, I think it's the Perelman Society. I'm probably messing that up because I'm not as steeped in libertarian lore as many, but I think he raises questions even all the way back in 1972 that are at the heart of the discussion that we've just had, which is he assumes that these, what if the self that is realized under the conditions of liberal capitalism is a self that despises liberal capitalism and uses its liberty to subvert and abolish a free society? To this question, Hayek and Friedman have no answer, and yet this is the question we now confront, as our society relentlessly breeds more and more such selves. Perhaps one can say that the secular libertarian tradition of capitalism, when it has too limited an imagination when it comes to vice, it could never really believe that vice unconstrained by religion, morality, and law might lead to viciousness. It never could really believe that the self-destructive nihilism was an authentic and permanent possibility that any society had to guard against. It could refute Marx effectively, but never thought it would be called upon to refute the Marquis de Sade. I think this is just very much something that's confronting all of us on the right as we consider these questions, as we consider, oh my goodness, the possibility that we might need to use the state to step in and protect some of the space for a political business, the space for the traditional liberties that we hold dear and that are the tradition, our tradition as a people. It's sort of confronting the fact that the framework that many of us were attached to in 2014 or 2008 when Brandon Eich was fired, in 2014 when he was fired, in 2008 when we had these discussions about gay marriage, that framework that many of us, including me, were attached to simply doesn't describe the world in which we see ourselves interacting with now as customers, as employers, as employees. So it's incumbent on us to find a framework that actually does describe the world around us. So thank you so much to everybody. I'm going to turn it over to Lita before we wrap up here, but thank you so much for joining this webinar.
Thank you so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our speakers today, Todd and Inez, for a fascinating conversation. And I also want to thank our audience for joining and participating and offering some great questions. Please join us again this coming Tuesday at noon for a webinar on Net Choice, Murthy, and the speech and coercion questions in the digital age. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you so much for joining us today. We are adjourned.